Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Kentucky launches a new education program with its federal Race to the Top grant.
It's a story of people who are assuming responsibility for the lives of their future.
Retired military members make a case for better climate change policy.
Norfolk and Norfolk Naval Air Station, in about 30 to 40 years, will probably go underwater.
Calling all photographers for help documenting Appalachia 50 years after the War on Poverty.
Photographers working in these 13 Appalachian states could photograph what they know as Appalachia.
An Appalachian village ushers in the Lenten season, West Virginia style.
It's marinated and then Henry fries it and we bake it and that keeps it nice and moist.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. One of President Obama's signature programs is Race to the Top, a competitive $4.3 billion grant program designed to reward states with plans for rigorous improvement in student achievement and for fulfilling certain criteria in their K-12 education systems. In December 2013, Eastern Kentucky was selected as one of only five places across the U.S. to receive a Race to the Top grant. WMMT's Sylvia Ryerson has this report.
The Kentucky Valley Educational Cooperative, or KVEC, is a consortia of 17 rural school districts across 12 counties in eastern Kentucky, including WMMT's home county of Letcher. Together, these districts include over 100 schools and serve 40,000 students. 76% of these students qualify for free or reduced lunch. 11 of the 12 counties are economically distressed and include four of the poorest counties in the United States. In 2012, after months of preparation and hard work, KVEC administrators received some bad news. The proposal they'd submitted to the U.S. Department of Education for Race to the Top district funding was a finalist, but in the end was not selected. This was heartbreaking. But rather than giving up, KVEC Executive Director Jeff Hawkins and staff decided to go back to the drawing board. They revised their whole application and resubmitted it in the fall of 2013. And the work paid off.
You persisted, and now here you sit, one of the five national grantees for the federal resources and the only rural collaborative in this country right now. That is a big deal.
Titled the Appalachian Renaissance Initiative, KVEC's proposal was funded for $30 million to be used over 4 years starting in 2014. In the middle of a late January snowstorm, principals, superintendents, and dedicated educators from across the region braved the winter roads and gathered at the Kentucky Career Center in Hazard for the initiative's official launch. Gene Wilhoit, director of the National Center for Innovation and Education at UK, and a former commissioner for the Kentucky Department of Education, welcomed the crowd.
You are now in a national leadership role. People are going to be looking at you for guidance and direction and from what you're learning. This is more than a grant. It's more than a project. It is a remarkable story. It's a story of people who are assuming responsibility for the lives of their future.
After opening comments, KVEC Executive Director Jeff Hawkins took the mic and got everyone in attendance on their feet to learn more about all the pieces involved.
But we're going to move you in five stations because this grant has five key components with lots of elements within them. Those components are personalized learn for every kid every day, teacher-educator effectiveness, teacher-principal superintendent, college and career readiness, next generation classrooms, and data availability, and fifth and nowhere near least, kindergarten readiness and student wellness. Those are the five core components of the grant. What we're gonna do, just for fun, is number off one through five. Ones will begin in this corner.
I counted off as a two. First stop, an impressive display on plans to create, quote, next generation classrooms, led by Johnson Central High School principal, Noel Crum.
And these next generation classrooms, there will actually be one placed in every single school, from elementary through high school. One of the things discussed when we were first looking at putting the grant together, and actually one of the big catalysts for all of it, was trying to figure out how we could connect the 17 districts in a way that hasn't happened before. Even though there's only a few miles that separate some of them, it may take an hour to drive between some of our districts. So one of the things we wanted to do was look at the vast difference in program offerings that we have. And I'll use an example at Johnson Central, where I am, we have an engineering program. Well, next door in McGoffin County, they don't have an engineering program right now. Through this Next Generation Classrooms, we see the potential that an instructor could be sitting at Johnson Central in a classroom, and a student in McGoffin County may receive that instruction if they don't have enough staffing for that, and one of our students may be getting instruction from somewhere else.
At another station, Desi Bowling, Associate Director of KVEC, walked us through the tools and strategies that will be implemented under the component aiming to make all students career and college ready.
With our region, of course, our coal jobs are disappearing and disappearing fast. And so with the My Strategic Compass, the kids will do like an interest inventory, and then they can log in and it will take them through seeing the coursework, the areas where that position may be located. And then if they don't want to leave here, they may need to refocus. One part of that, and this is just an example, I was working with a student, a ninth grade student, and he was interested in being an auto mechanic. And so through this coursework, then we got on there and we looked at the coursework that he could take in high school, and we found that there was an apprenticeship available, a local apprenticeship in Stanton, and this young man was in Breathitt County, and so that was very appealing to him.
And as Hawkins sees it, student health and wellness is critical to making any of it work.
We need kids to be in school and be healthy, to be well-fed, to get the correct exercise, and that makes them a better learner. But we cannot do that only through the school.
The initiative is as much about building collaborations between schools and other institutions, from local hospitals and healthcare clinics to community action agencies and colleges, as it is about making improvements within schools. The plan includes partnering with 21 different outside groups from all different sectors. It's not going to be easy. As Hawkins is well aware, there are huge challenges ahead, and so much of the work has to start from the very beginning for kids.
They probably told you earlier that on average about 10% of our kids come to school academically ready for kindergarten, which is frightening and means essentially for our K-12 systems that the trajectory of that kids have to move between kindergarten and third grade for us is incredibly steeper than it is for other parts of the country. So what we'll be able to do, I think, is work with the Head Start providers, the preschool providers, the daycare centers, and provide them resources. That's not enough, because about 50% of our kids are in a kith and kin center. They're being cared for by family or extended family members, so they're not part of that formal early childhood training. But what we're going to try to do is to work with those parents, grandparents, and caregivers to help them have the tools necessary to get a kid ready academically by kindergarten. One thing that we will address is the number of kids in our region who are not currently being raised by their natural-born parents, who may be being raised by extended family members or in foster care. And there are a lot of those kids, so being able to reach out and work with grandparents or work with the foster community and do it in a sensible way so that we're not beating people over the head, but how can you play games that are correct? How can you provide the right information about healthcare needs and that sort of thing? It is really important to being able to do this work.
The day ended with remarks from Ashley Bergman, a sophomore at Knott County Central, who was one of many students from across the district that took part in the planning process for the Appalachian Renaissance Initiative.
I believe that our thoughts and ideas were important in this process. There were over 1,000 letters of support written for this grant application. I'd like to share a few thoughts expressed in some of those letters just to let you know the hopes that people across the region had for this work. A business owner wrote, "As a local businessman, I understand the value and importance of career readiness as we are continually challenged to hire skilled employees and can compete on a global basis. I hope this grant will help make our communities more work ready." A grandparent wrote, "There are some things my granddaughter talks about that I don't know anything about. She is excited about school and excited about learning. I want her to stay that way, and I hope that this program will give me a chance to help her stay excited." A high school student wrote, "People tell me all the time to think about my future and that technology and new inventions will change the world. Thinking about the future scares me. Our teacher told us that we would all probably change careers 7 times and that we might have a job that doesn't even exist yet. I hope this grant will let us use technology more and make the future a little less scary."
Elwood Cornett of Letcher County was the first director of KVEC when it began over 40 years ago. And for Cornett, the event was a particularly special day.
"Well, it's always been kind of my baby. I think of it that way, and to see this happen to it now makes me just as proud as I can be. So I'm proud of Jeff and all the folks that's put this together, and I think it'll make a real difference in the education of our children."
Receiving this grant makes Eastern Kentucky the only region in the country to be awarded funds from both Race to the Top and Investing in Innovation, the two flagship education programs of President Obama and Education Secretary Arne Duncan that are competitive for school districts to apply for. The odds of getting both were astronomical. And as Hawkins sees it,
"It's also really timely within the region because SOAR took place a few months ago, which is really making people rethink what's going on. Some of the counties in this affected area are now part of the Promise Zone that has been created in Eastern Kentucky. We believe lots of things where we work, but we try to talk all the time about the economy, and that's the place where educational improvement meets economic development. And that area within the Venn diagram is really the sweet spot for being able to continue."
Jeff Hawkins, Executive Director of the Kentucky Valley Educational Cooperative. Reporting for WMMT in Whitesburg, I'm Sylvia Ryerson.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. One of the nation's largest coal producers will pay more than $27 million in fines and spend another $200 million in a settlement with the federal government. As Kentucky Public Radio's Erica Peterson reports, Alpha Natural Resources was fined for violating water pollution limits in Kentucky, West Virginia, Tennessee, Pennsylvania, and Virginia.
The settlement is for more than 6,000 violations between 2006 and last year. Some of the violations were at mines owned by other companies, like Massey Energy, that Alpha purchased. The EPA says the company's Appalachian mines discharged large amounts of heavy metals directly into streams. Alpha's Senior Vice President Gene Kitz says the company has already implemented advanced technology to control pollution at some of its coal mines.
"We feel the settlement is fair. We have systems already going into place."
Kitz says the settlement payout won't affect ongoing operations or cause the company to close any mines or lay off any workers. This is the largest penalty the EPA has ever levied under Section 402 of the Clean Water Act. After the settlement was announced, environmental groups sent out a statement criticizing the agency for letting the pollution happen in the first place. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Erica Peterson.
A bill introduced in the West Virginia legislature this year attempts to promote deer farming by taking the oversight of deer away from the Division of Natural Resources and giving it to the state agriculture department. Meanwhile, Kentucky legislators are also talking about deer and giving working farmers more options when it comes to dealing with wildlife that eat their crops. WEKU's Stu Johnson reports.
The bill, easily approved by the House Agriculture and Small Business Committee, would give landowners or their designees the authority to kill or trap any wildlife causing damage to crops or personal property. Jeff Harper with the Kentucky Farm Bureau says it also allows for the speedy removal of animal carcasses.
The one thing that we wanted to be very careful of was not to do anything to harm the sport of hunting or anything to harm wildlife. But at the same time, they were causing crop loss.
Harper says faster removal of dead animals will allow for quicker processing, and that can benefit food bank organizations. State Division of Wildlife Director Karen Alexey Waldrop says management of the female deer population is a long-term way to help remedy crop loss problems.
What we want to do is work with landowners and show them how to decrease the population on their property. Doing it out of season and just shooting when they're causing damage, that's not going to solve the problem.
Waldrop says her agency continues to look for long-term solutions to the deer problem. For WEKU News, I'm Stu Johnson.
This year, Mississippi bumped West Virginia out of the bottom in the list of most obese states in the nation. The report says Mississippi's obesity rate is 35.4%, while West Virginia's is 34.4%. The national rate is 27.1%, which is 1.6 percentage points higher than the year before. The report says Tennessee is the seventh most obese state. It ranks Ohio at 8th and Kentucky at 9th. The report is based on telephone interviews conducted January 2nd to December 29th, 2013, as part of the Gallup Healthways Well-Being Index. It says people living in the 10 most obese states have higher rates of chronic disease like high cholesterol, diabetes, heart conditions, and cancer. Last month, U.S. District Court Judge John Hayburn ruled that Kentucky's ban on gay marriage violated the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution, effectively allowing out-of-state same-sex marriages to be recognized in Kentucky. In an emotional press conference Tuesday, Kentucky Attorney General Jack Conway announced that his office would not appeal Hayburn's decision, saying that to do so would be to defend discrimination. But at the same time, Governor Steve Beshear is seeking outside counsel to lead an appeal effort. Kentucky Public Radio's Jonathan Meter spoke with Conway about his decision and the reactions to it.
I could have tried to defend this law and made a statement that I don't agree with it, but I'm going to try to defend it. And he would have seemed as wishy-washy.
That's Attorney General Jack Conway, his eyes still watering from an emotional press conference just hours earlier when he decided not to appeal an historic federal ruling that overturned portions of the state's ban on same-sex marriage.
She said, "Jack, you really stink when you're not authentic."
However, there are plenty of people in Frankfort who think Conway's decision stinks.
I think the decision that the Attorney General made today was about whether he should do his constitutional job. And he basically said that he was not going to do that.
That's Martin Cothran of the Conservative Family Foundation. His group has been involved in the case at issue and says that Governor Steve Beshear's intention to appeal Hayburn's ruling via outside counsel makes Conway look bad.
To have an executive branch, which is seems to be not very enthusiastic about defending it, doing this is really a second best kind of thing. We would prefer the body that passed the law and that is more answerable to the people have some standing in this case.
Cothran supports a bill being considered by Republican Senator Dan Syme, which would allow the House Speaker, the Senate President, or a third-party entity like the Family Foundation to appeal in cases like this. Although Syme acknowledges the bill may not be needed in light of Governor Beshear's decision to appeal, he says that since marriage is historically a state's rights issue, the legislature may need that power to defend a more traditional view of marriage.
This is not an anti-gay issue necessarily, because the legislation that we passed going back, I think, in 2004 was basically one man, one woman. So we also are saying that if let's say a state out there wants to approve multiple marriages, it may come from the Mormon side of this thing. Do we have a state right to reject that issue? Should we have multiple marriages?
But Conway says Syme's efforts would be in vain. He cites a U.S. Supreme Court ruling involving California's same-sex marriage ban, known as Prop 8, and the Defense of Marriage Act. The court dismissed the case, Conway says, because they ruled that the third parties litigating it didn't have standing for their claims.
Senator Syme might want to educate himself a little bit on the constitutional standing issue before we pass another piece of unconstitutional legislation.
Chris Hartman, director of Kentucky's Fairness Campaign, agrees with Conway, but is disappointed in Beshear's intent to appeal. This week marks the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s March on Frankfurt. Hartman says it dovetails perfectly with the issue, and, like in the civil rights era that preceded it, people are realizing that they don't want to be on the wrong side of history.
No one wants to be on the wrong side of that history, to tell their children that when the moment came to make the decision of whether or not to stand up for people in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, no one wants to say that they took a seat.
And neither did Conway, who in his press conference said he made his decision with his daughter's judgment in mind. Afterward, free from microphones and the gaze of news cameras and still misty-eyed, Conway says he called his wife Elizabeth to discuss what had happened.
She said, you know, I've seen what you read. It's made me almost cry several times. And I said, well, honey, I did cry. I cried in front of the whole world. So how about that? And she laughed.
And as Bashir has already begun seeking an attorney for his appeal, we're bound to see more laughter and tears as the case builds. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Meter.
Secretary of State John Kerry recently grabbed headlines by calling climate change a weapon of mass destruction. But way before that, he helped start a bipartisan think tank to carry out the same message. Now, some retired high-ranking military are foot soldiers for that group, the American Security Project. They recently started a 9-state tour in Pittsburgh. The Allegheny Front's Jennifer Jordan reports.
Retired Marine Brigadier General Stephen Cheney directs the think tank. He told graduate students at Pitt why then-Senator Kerry and other politicians from both parties founded the American Security Project after the 2004 elections.
And their thought behind it was a number of issues that were brought up during the campaign, when you talked about them, got painted one way or the other, far left or far right, without looking at the facts concerning them, and in particular was climate change. And you would well imagine some talk climate change and polar bears, Sierra Club, Greenpeace, tree huggers, far left. And nobody ever really paid attention to what the facts of that of the issue was.
Cheney says the project's done a lot of their work inside the D.C. Beltway on topics like climate change, nuclear and alternative energy. But their funders insisted that they get out into the real world. And their message was not just that climate change is real, but that we Americans are causing it. Cheney and others say erratic weather events that are more likely with climate change are already sucking up military resources.
Hurricane Sandy turned into a major joint operation for the United States military. Every service was involved. The Marine Expeditionary Unit went to New York. How do you plan for that? How do you budget for that?
Cheney predicts storms and flooding could cost Pittsburgh $1 billion in the coming years. Globally, he says drought in Mali and severe fires in Russia are at least partly responsible for deadly uprisings that required American military attention. Cheney says those droughts and fires may be caused by climate change. At the same time, military bases around the world are at risk from rising sea levels.
Norfolk and Norfolk Naval Air Station, in about 30 to 40 years, will probably go underwater. I served 30-plus years in the Marines. Where are most of our bases and stations? They're on the coast. They're all going to be impacted. Diego Garcia, which is one of our major staging bases for logistics in the Indian Ocean, it's a goner, I think.
Still, the speakers said there is reason for some level of optimism.
We're probably going to push this about as far as we humanly can, and then we're going to pull it out of our you-know-where at the very last minute.
That's David Titley. He's a retired Navy Rear Admiral. He now directs Penn State's Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk. In the audience, Steve Hernandez stood listening. He's an Air Force lieutenant colonel who was thinking about how he'll convey what he heard with students he works with in ROTC.
No, I think probably the most practical thing is really just to beat the drum, to spread the word, and I think educate folks that I encounter and that I teach about facts. And I think those facts will lead to a conclusion that climate change is a serious deal, and it's something we have to confront sooner rather than later.
Another generation of soldiers got to hear from the American Security Project later on the Pittsburgh tour. The think tank took their presentation to veterans of the Korean and Vietnam Wars at a VFW. John McDowell was an infantryman in the famed 101st Airborne Division in Vietnam. Reached by phone after the talk, he says he believes his group bought into what Cheney and Titley said in large part because of the speaker's rank.
I would like to see these guys get more exposure. Even if it turns out that the human race isn't causing this, if we do stop polluting like we're doing now, it can't hurt.
The American Security Project started its tour in Pittsburgh because it's considered to be a ground zero for energy sources that could emit fewer of the greenhouse gases that cause climate change, sources of power like nuclear and natural gas. The group will march on through Colorado, Tennessee, Texas, and several other states with their climate change presentation.
That's the Allegheny Front's Jennifer Jordan. The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. Have you ever replaced a broken egg at the grocery store? Well, unfortunately, in Kentucky anyway, you broke the law. Kentucky Public Radio's John Knoll has more on a bill awaiting Governor Steve Beshear's signature that aims to allow grocers to do the mixing and matching for you.
Representative Pete.
In February, at a Paducah Chamber of Commerce legislative briefing, Graves County Representative Richard Heath seemed a bit disappointed about the progress of the 2014 session.
It just seems like we're halfway through and we haven't accomplished much.
But Heath extolled Representative Will Corsi's efforts to make Benton's annual Tater Day an official Department of Agriculture event, as well as making the fourth Saturday in July Cowboy Day in the Commonwealth. But the bell cow of Heath's Ag Committee seems to be House Bill 181, or as co-signer Heath called it, the all-important egg bill.
So we have passed a bill that you could, I'm serious.
The laughter continued as Heath explained the bill's purpose. Currently, it's illegal for the customer or grocer to replace broken eggs that they find in store. In the event of a bad egg, the grocery store is supposed to sell the carton with 11 eggs or send it to the store's bakery or deli. Heath says House Bill 181 will let the grocery train an employee to undertake the good work of egg repurposing.
And they have to make sure that the egg that they put in place of that broken one comes from the same lot number, has the same expiration date, and it's the same size, you know, large, medium, or small, so the customer is not getting ripped off.
But what was the necessity behind this bill? Are groceries hemorrhaging money? Are people being prosecuted left and right for plucking a single egg out of its carton?
Do you know of anybody that has been actually prosecuted for doing this themselves?
No, I sure don't. But, you know, that's certainly a big fear.
That's Tom Litzler, an egg lobbyist who has served on the Kentucky Egg Marketing Board for almost a decade. Litzler says the status quo has created pricing problems and a waste of product.
I can assure you we have more eggs available this way than we have use for in our delis. And there are a lot of retailers that don't even have delis. So it has put Kentucky retailers that sell eggs into a situation where they've had to throw good eggs away.
Murray State University student Jordan Dodd has worked for the food giant grocery in Eddyville for 5 years. He says he stocks eggs regularly and that it's not uncommon for the deli to be given more eggs than they need.
Out of 20 cartons, I'd say like more than half would be, you'd probably find a broken egg due to like rough handling.
Dodd says in his time at Food Giant, he has also seen entire cartons that were cracked or broken. Litzler says that largely cracked eggs are a result of curious shoppers, not the distributors.
People want to open up that carton and make sure all those eggs are good in it. When they do that, there's sometimes a danger of dropping a carton or sticking a finger into an egg, or something like that.
Taking care not to stick any fingers into eggs. An informal, extremely unscientific survey of cartons at a Murray grocery store revealed more than half of cartons had at least one broken egg in them. If and when Governor Beshear signs the bill into law, grocery store managers will be able to apply for certification so they can begin to correct this problem themselves. Now, what was that about Cowboy Day? For WKMS News, I'm John Knoll.
It's been a cold winter and many bodies of water have frozen over this year. Some fishermen and women are making the most of the frigid temperatures and the last few days of ice fishing in Pennsylvania. The Allegheny Front's Kara Holsopple joined some anglers on the frozen Allegheny River in Armstrong County to find out about their love for the sport and the outdoors.
It's about 6 a.m., still dark, and Luke Woolley hauls a sled with about 200 pounds of ice fishing equipment and supplies over 6 inches of snow in the moonlight.
It's just real important we get our baits in before the sun comes up. There's a big flurry of activity as it starts to get a little bit lighter.
Woolley's a born fisherman. He grew up in his family's fish market in Pittsburgh, and now he has his own seafood restaurant. but ice fishing is his real passion, even though it's just 5 degrees this morning.
We're on the Allegheny River. Right now we're probably on about 5 to 6 inches of ice. Almost never freezes like this, not that I've ever seen. But it opens up a lot of new fishing spots.
Wooly and some friends are headed to a somewhat secret spot on the river where the water is slower moving and the ice is thicker, about a quarter of a mile from where their cars are parked. It's close to the shore.
See the rock pile going right in? That's going to be the most structure in the whole spot. Structure is like fish habitat where fish can hide, small fish can hide, and the big predator fish will just lay in ambush whenever they come out to feed.
It's getting harder to walk because there's some slush between the snow and the icy hard surface. But now the real work begins, drilling the fishing holes. Wooly pulls out a drill with a spiral blade as long as his leg.
We're going to turn the auger on, close the choke, give her a pull.
Got at least a foot, at least 12 inches.
Nicholas Colangelo scans the depth of the ice and removes some of it around the edges to get to the water. Then he starts to bait some line. Colangelo scoops the bait fish out of a bucket with an orange ladle. It's so cold, it keeps freezing over. He pierces the wriggling fish with a 4-point hook and helps Wooly lower it about 35 feet down to almost the bottom of the river.
You just put the fish right down in there?
Yep.
And they repeat the whole process about 20 times. The holes are yards apart, some so far away you have to squint to see them. Wooly says he can catch crappie, perch, bluegills, muskie, and catfish here. The line's connected to what looks like a small plastic manhole cover.
This is what's known as a tip-up. It's a fishing device that you just lay on top of the ice hole and basically wait for a fish to come and bite it.
When a fish takes the bait, a neon flag on a spring pops up. It doesn't take long for that to happen. When it does, they take off across the ice. Within a minute, they're kneeling next to a hole, gloves off, and Wooly begins working the fishing line through his fingers.
Take your time.
I am.
After 15 minutes of tug of war, Wooly reaches his hand into the water, the hook tattoo on his forearm exposed. He guides the fish's golden head through the hole. Then, the payoff.
Woo! Yes! That is what we came here for. That's awesome. The biggest muskie I've ever caught.
Woo!
Man, my hands are cold. Oh my God.
Later, everyone is gathered around a tent on the ice, waiting for another flag to go up. They pass around plastic spoons so they can warm up with a cup of chili. Wooly says he loves bringing friends and newcomers out on the ice.
The more that people know about what we have, it's, you know, that's how we're going to protect these resources. That's how we're going to continue to have the rivers be, you know, as clean as they are. And there's always room for improvement. I mean, the rivers, you know, fishing could get even better. You know, a lot of times it's not about what you can take from the land. It's about what you have and being happy with what we have.
He surveys the surface of the glistening snow as he talks.
Ooh, I think there's a flag up.
Flag up for the Allegheny Front and Carol Holsopple.
Ooh, something had this one. He let it go.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Appalachian photographer and West Virginia native Roger May is taking on a new project looking at the region 50 years after the War on Poverty. May has set up a website and issued a call to photographers to submit photos from any county in the Appalachian region.
The images that were used to sort of shop that campaign around were often very derogatory and sort of inflammatory of Appalachia as a whole, although the photographs that most people identify with were, you know, made in those even those early days in Inez, Kentucky, and Martin County. And I thought a really good way to celebrate the 50th anniversary would be to crowdsource a project whereby photographers working in these 13 Appalachian states could photograph what they know as Appalachia. and use these photographs as sort of a visual archive to stand as a mark in time of this is what Appalachia looks like 50 years later, to not continue to be visually defined by Appalachia 50 years ago.
Do you think that people do still visualize Appalachia that way?
I think so. I think if you're not from there, it's very easy to do. In fact, even I guess if you're from there, it can still be easy to see Appalachia that way. You know, most folks, I believe, probably think of Appalachia as a very small cluster of states, primarily West Virginia, Kentucky, maybe Tennessee, and parts of northern Georgia and western North Carolina and that sort of thing. But we know from the Appalachian Regional Commission's map that their definition of Appalachia stretches from southern New York State all the way through northeast Mississippi, which is a huge region and one that most folks probably don't think of right offhand as being Appalachia. So I think I'm excited about the scope of this project and where it can go in terms of showing not only others what Appalachia truly looks like, but also ourselves, because I think a lot of folks who even live in what's considered to be Appalachia maybe don't identify as being Appalachian.
And what more do you think will be found by having people go out and photograph it today?
I think in some cases, there'll still maybe be more questions than answers. At least I hope in some way that that's the case, because I'm interested in the types of conversations that are going to come out of this project, not only from individual photographers, but from, you know, academics and scholars and sociologists and all folklorists and those sorts of people. And that is to sort of pull back and think about what it is to be from Appalachia, visually, how has it changed? Has it changed? I don't really know. And I think that's a really exciting element of this, is that I really, really don't know. I mean, I've been pleased with what I've seen come in so far, but I hope to see the really rich diversity of the region.
I think it's interesting that you chose to go the route of looking at the Appalachian Regional Commission website and identifying those counties and saying, this is where I want the photographs to be from.
I felt like it was important to establish some parameters. And some of those are, you know, that the work has to be made in 2014. And so right out of the box, I wanted to say from about late February, when I launched the project, through the 31st of December of this year, you're going to have this entire year to go photograph whatever region of Appalachia, you know, that you want to. The deadline is 31 December. And the next hard and fast rule is that the photograph has to be made in one of the counties defined by the Appalachian Regional Commission as Appalachia. I feel like the significance of the organization and the history of the organization, coupled with the anniversary of the War on Poverty, that's a fair match there to use that as a framework to work within for this project. Of course, the other hard and fast rule is that the photograph has to be yours. It has to be the photographer's copyright.
Now, when you get all these photographs collected and curated and posted, is that where they're going to stay, or do you have plans to print them at some point or do something with them in the future?
Yeah, well, the great hope is to move them from pixels to prints. Not all photographs, of course, but you know, there are a lot of things that I'm still trying to partner with folks and work behind the scenes with folks to maybe secure some funding and have some support to see this come through and move from web to gallery to traveling exhibition to, you know, possibly a book or, you know, an exhibition catalog or something of that nature. I think it's important that the work live somewhere other than just online. And I hope that, you know, at the end of this project that we've we've amassed enough work that we can sort of cull some of this project down to, you know, X number of photographs, that we would be able to find some funding to have those printed and matted and framed, and then coordinate with various people, hopefully and ideally in each of the 13 states. Yeah, I'm really excited about, you know, the educational aspect of this. I would love to, you know, partner with colleges or universities that would be interested in hosting it or helping guide it through the Appalachian region. But I think ideally it would be, it would just be really nice to also be able to give something back to all of the photographers that have contributed, you know, that they can come away with a tangible product of their effort.
Now, explain what people can do to get involved.
Sure. Well, the place to start is the website, and that's looking at appalachia.org. And it's pretty self-explanatory from there. I list an overview, some sort of backstory about the War on Poverty and the scope of the project. There's a submissions link that goes through all of the details of the submission process, the specifics there. My email address is there as well, so if folks have any questions, they're more than welcome to email me, and I will get back to them as soon as possible. There's also a Defining Appalachia link on there that is virtually copied and pasted from the Appalachian Regional Commission site, which has a map of the Appalachian region, as well as a breakdown by state of every county that's considered Appalachian in there. So if there are any questions, one should be able to navigate to that and find out if, you know, if their county or a county that they want to photograph in is Appalachian. There's also links on the website to our social media presence, our Facebook page, and our Instagram account. One of the things too that we'll be doing with Instagram is we'll be hosting guest Instagrammers from around the region. So folks in Alabama or New York or Pennsylvania will be able to sort of take over the Instagram account for a set period of time and you know, make pictures with their iPhones or their mobile phones, post them to Instagram, and use a series of hashtags to identify the county and the state and that sort of thing, just as sort of a much less formal visual conversation on that platform.
Well, Roger May, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. To usher in the Lenten season, New Orleans has Mardi Gras, Brazil has Carnival, and West Virginia has a pre-Lenten celebration in its own little Swiss village in the mountains. Every year, Helvetia in Randolph County hosts a Fasnacht celebration. This year, hundreds of people throng the streets, many of them squeezing into the community hall for the square dance. People had large papier-mâché masks that resembled long-nosed monsters, Chinese dragons, and druid-like trees. But before the party, cooks and volunteers were busy helping to prepare the Swiss feast in the only restaurant in town, the Hütte. The feast included sausage, spiced sauerkraut, bratwurst, green beans, parsley potatoes, homemade applesauce, and peach cobbler. 3 years after one of the most important matriarchs of Helvetia, Eleanor Mayhew, founder of the Hütte, passed away, the question many people are asking is, how will the traditions change without her? Traveling 219's Roxy Todd brings us this story.
On Saturday morning, I woke to the smell of curry and countless other spices wafting up to my room above the Hütte, where I was staying. And as I sat down for coffee beside the crackling wood stove, the smells grew more intense, and I could hear something frying in the kitchen. One of the cooks was frying the Morgan Henley chicken in olive oil, so I went to have a closer look.
I can't give the spices away. I can say this much, it's a curry chicken. It's marinated, and then Henry fries it, and it's we bake it, and that keeps it nice and moist.
Debbie has worked at the Houthi since 1977, and like many here, her family roots go back to Switzerland.
Mostly, Debbie makes her homemade bread, and she's made it for years, and then Wilma Sanders makes our whole wheat bread, and the sausage is what a lot of people love, and we get that from Campbell's Market, shoulder sausage, very lean, and then we have nine different spices that go into it, grated onion and a whole bunch of other things that I won't tell you about. It's wonderful, and people love it.
Yeah, the two different sausages, they're different.
I'm Heidi Farner Mayhew Arnett. My mom was Eleanor Mayhew.
Since her mother, Eleanor Mayhew, passed away 3 years ago, Heidi and four others in her family have been keeping the restaurant going, just as before.
And we don't care, we don't want to make a dime, we just want to continue this. And the staff is amazing. They've been working with us for years.
Eleanor, she worked with the recipes over the years to get them where she wanted them. Quite a lady, wasn't she, Melissa? Yeah, we miss her. But we're doing what she taught us to do. And she worked hard to get us where we're at today.
Preserving the old ways of cooking Swiss foods wasn't the only tradition that Eleanor Mayhew helped inspire here. Bringing back Fasnacht was also part of her creative vision for reviving Helvetia.
Fasnacht is something that happened many years ago that they always celebrated. What they used to do, I think, is go to farm, and they used to have a glass of wine and a rosette or a Hoseblatz and go to the next house, and it was like a party. So many of the local families were musicians, and so they would play songs and hang out, and it was a lot of fun. That was one of the things also that my mom kind of wanted to get going back again, because it was something that they used to celebrate. So we had people sleeping on the dining room table, under the dining room table, and my mom was all for it. She loved kids.
After dinner, hundreds of people slip on their costumes and oversized papier-mâché masks and parade through the small town towards the dance hall. In circles and pairs, weaving beneath a scarecrow-esque effigy of Old Man Winter, they dance for hours.
It's always a hard winter here because we're in the mountains, so burning him is really therapeutic.
Everything on Old Man Winter gets burned every year. And square dancing, and that they love it so much, and it's a great thing to be a part of. So, yeah, we love it.
At midnight, someone cuts down Old Man Winter from the ceiling. Hallie Martin of Elkins Middle School is given the honor this year of hauling Old Man Winter onto the bonfire amid cheers and howls from the crowd. In a way, this is West Virginia's Mardi Gras. Right. It's 40 degrees, and Old Man Winter has been temporarily put to shame. Some of the local people begin to sing John Denver's Country Roads, and somebody throws a dead wild boar they found nearby onto the fire, and the flames grow higher. Maybe the burning of a wild boar and the singing of Country Roads will become new traditions, blending with all the others of Helvetia. It's for the next generation to decide what comes next here, anyway.
You know what I like about Helvetia is that you can be who you are. I love Helvetia people, and I'm Pickens people and Czar people. They're the purity of just being who you are. It's a freedom. You know, you're very free out here to be who you are.
This story was produced by Roxy Todd of the Traveling 219 Project, a production of Allegheny Mountain Radio with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the West Virginia Humanities Council, and AmeriCorps Vista. To learn more, go to traveling219.com. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.